This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Expect to fill all those rooms and then some. People are very passionate about this, and it means a lot to all our community.
Talk to me about the sponsors of the bill. My research suggests you've got four in the House and four in the Senate. Is this bill on a dual track?
That I know of, no. It's just they're just going to run it through both of these, the House and the Senate, one right after the other. Right after this hearing, they're going to present it in the Senate really soon, I understand. Yes, it's a bipartisan. We have support from both sides, from both parties. So we're really excited that Oregon wants to move forward on this as a community, and this is a great step in working together. So super excited about that.
So after today, what's the next step?
After today, the next step is in our communities, what we're doing is having dialogues with our community leaders in law enforcement, faith, and also community leaders. In Central Oregon, for example, I'm going to have a negotiation to ask for support from city council members, county commissioners, and police, and whoever we can, and just send letters to the Department of Transportation and tell them that we support this, to send them to the Ways and Means Committee, to get some response from our communities to that. In favor of this bill.
Now, the law surrounding driver's licenses and how we obtain them, that changed in 2008. What was the impact for the undocumented workers?
The impact for the undocumented community was, first of all, as a community as a whole, they left the roads with 86,000 people that would ultimately lose their driving privileges. And out due to the fact that they felt that there was a need to tie it to a citizenship, driving privileges is a public safety issue, and it affected everybody. You know, this is, I think, I would say that this is affecting licensed drivers as much as unlicensed drivers. You know, the public safety issue of insured driver, 86,000 people that were assuming that they lost their driving privileges will not be on the road anymore. That's kind of a scary thought to just assume that. You know, so, and also with this, it was a loss of identity. People could not, you know, rent houses. They could not. They couldn't even open a bank account because they don't have an ID.
And how did that law get changed in the first place back in 2008? Who promoted that?
That was a law that was signed into action by the former governor, Colin Gowski, right before he left office. There was an initiative to tie it to, it was under the True ID Act. And under that, they were pushing the statewide to get the licenses tied to a social security number or to tie to something of that nature.
So for folks who want to get more information and find out what the status is of the bill and your organization's role and how things have come about, where can they go for information?
They can go to the CASA website, casaoregon.org. A lot of information is all our information is on there. And the times of the hearing dates and when the votes are being projected, that'll all be on the CASA website, casaoregon.org.
This is Robin Ryan for KBOO News.
Today, Oregon's public pensioners found themselves on the losing end of partisan efforts to achieve a balanced state budget. A Democrat-sponsored bill to cut public retiree benefits has passed in the Oregon Senate with a vote of 16-13. Senate Bill 822 will reduce the annual 2% cost of living increase that most retired public employees receive under the Public Employees Retirement System, or PERS. A new tiered system will dole out yearly increases based on income. The cuts are expected to free up more than $800 million in the 2013 to 2015 budget. Today's vote was split along partisan lines, but disappointed rhetoric is emerging from both sides of the aisle. Republicans and school advocates contend the bill won't do enough to make up for gaps in school budgets. In public testimony, state retirees said they felt shortchanged by the proposal and asked why the wealthy weren't shouldering more of the fiscal burden. Democrats insist that the bill is an equitable alternative to raising taxes. Senate Bill 822 now moves on to the Oregon House floor.
Local officials have announced plans to hit the so-called reset button on the 10-year plan to end homelessness. Today, Multnomah County commissioners voted unanimously to create action teams, which will coordinate with the City of Portland and other jurisdictions to develop specific proposals to address homelessness. The move follows a similar vote yesterday by the Portland City Council. County Commissioner Deborah Cafori told the Oregonian that local officials plan to coordinate efforts and funds in ways unseen before. The impact of these announcements on the city's battle with Right to Dream 2, the prominent homeless rest area in downtown Portland, is largely unknown. Meanwhile, fines on what the city calls an illegal camp and pressure to move the rest area from developers such as David Gold continue to grow. In the past month, Right to Dream 2 has assisted 10 residents transition into housing. According to the executive director of Home Forward, formerly known as the Housing Authority of Portland, 12,000 people have been moved into permanent housing since the 10-year plan began in 2004. KABU will have more on the new plans and their impact tomorrow night.
Yesterday, the Obama administration released their proposed budget for the upcoming fiscal year. According to a report released Tuesday by the National Alliance to End Homelessness, this budget includes funding for programs that have been responsible for significant declines in chronic homelessness. Between 2011 and 2012, the report says, homelessness dropped by approximately 7% nationally, despite high unemployment. A press release issued today from the group cautions that funding for the programs is dependent upon Congress eliminating sequestration-related spending cuts. For more, KABU's Rebecca Ney spoke with Steve Berg, the Vice President of Programs and Policy for the National Alliance to End Homelessness.
Steve, how does President Obama's budget address the issue of homelessness?
Well, I think it addresses it directly in a couple of different ways. There are some key federal programs that I think communities have found very useful in reducing the number of homeless people. One of those is at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, there's the homeless assistance programs like the Continuum of Care, which provides money for local nonprofits and local government to run programs to get homeless people back into housing. And that's a key element. And then there's also the administration has had a special focus on homelessness among veterans. And so the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs has a set of programs that are doing the same thing, are trying to get homeless veterans back into housing quickly. And the budget proposes substantial increases for both of those sets of programs.
How will some of these programs allow folks to not only obtain housing, but also help them keep it?
It's getting people housing, working with landlords, doing rent subsidies, but then also making sure that people are matched up with other resources available in the community that helps them get jobs and helps them overcome whatever other kinds of problems they're having. I think that's a key part of this solution.
And how do the issues of foreclosure impact homelessness, and how is this being addressed?
Well, I think most people who are homeowners and then get foreclosed still manage to find other ways to keep themselves housed. We just haven't seen large numbers of people who are homeowners who are getting foreclosed and then go immediately into homelessness. What we have seen is people who are maybe living as tenants, secondary residents in houses that get foreclosed on, they're ending up homeless.
Your press release also mentions that this budget is also dependent upon the sequestration cuts.
The president's budget contains a comprehensive proposal to undo the sequestration-related additional cuts in spending and to replace those with other deficit reduction measures. So we'll see what the chances of that are. I mean, I think there's been a lot of negotiation between the president and Congress about how the budget deficit, how federal debt should be reduced over the long term. In the meantime, the kinds of things I talked about that really directly affect homeless are, when push comes to shove, they're fairly small items in the context of the whole federal budget. And we believe that even if sequestration is not undone, there's still money to do those kind of things. and that they should be the priority. I mean, not having kids and veterans and people with disabilities sleeping in the streets should be the number one priority. And I think the groups that work on homelessness in places like Portland have done such a good job on that that they've shown that it doesn't take much to make a big difference in the amount of homelessness in a community. It's something we should do no matter what happens with sequestration.
How do we support the folks that have banded together and organized homeless camps like what we're seeing in Portland with the Right to Dream 2 camp?
You know, around the country since the start of the recession, we saw an increase in people sleeping outside, people in camps. And, you know, it's like it's better to have a camp that's organized and that's not harassed by law enforcement than to have a camp that is. Our personal feeling, you can do a lot better than having people sleep outside in a camp. So the thing about getting people into permanent housing, that's actually what we should be doing. We should be making camps obsolete by ensuring that everybody can get into real housing. So, I mean, we're supportive of people who are doing work like that as sort of a temporary thing, but we really need to do much better than that.
I've been speaking with Steve Berg about President Obama's proposed budget and how it addresses issues of homelessness. Steve is the Vice President of Programs and Policy at the National Alliance to End Homelessness. This is Rebecca Ney with KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Tillicum Wawa at 6. And at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be mostly cloudy with patchy morning fog and a high near 61 degrees. Tomorrow night will be rainy with lows dropping to 44 degrees.
It's a quarter after 5 o'clock. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
I like the word lift. It implies upward progress and a can-do communal spirit. Yes, let's all put our backs into it and lift this load. It's so American. That's why I was intrigued to see the emergence of a new group called the Lift America Coalition. The acronym stands for Let's Invest for Tomorrow. And boy, is that overdue in everything from public education to development of a green economy. But then, I peeked behind the shiny Lift America logo and, uh-oh, there was Caterpillar, Coca-Cola, Eli Lilly, IBM, Intel, Pfizer, Procter & Gamble, Xerox, and, well, all the usual global giants that constantly want Washington to do special favors for them. Despite its uplifting name, Lift America is nothing but another corporate lobbying and PR front trying to dupe our Congress critters into giving them a lift. In particular, they're crying for a lower corporate tax rate, wailing about antiquated U.S. tax laws that are threatening America's economic competitiveness. Big bad government, they preach, has saddled these poor giants with a 35% tax bite, one of the highest of industrialized nations. So Congress must whack that rate to make America, quote, a more attractive place to invest and create jobs. Not so fast, Slick. First, these super-rich powerhouses are masters of the tax-dodging and loophole game. So the rate they actually pay is not 35%, but 12%. And many of them pay zero. Second, they've already slashed their commitment to America not only by offshoring jobs and eliminating our middle-class future, but also by reducing the percentage of our nation's revenue that corporations pay from 30% in the 1950s to less than 8% today. This is Jim Hightower saying, if corporations think Luxembourg is more attractive than America, move there.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Several developments in the pre-trial proceedings of Army whistleblower Bradley Manning have broken in the last couple of days. Manning is being charged by the U.S. military for his involvement in massive leaks of Afghan and Iraqi war reports, U.S. diplomatic cables, and other classified videos and records to the transparency website WikiLeaks. Yesterday, the judge in his case ruled that the prosecution must prove that Manning knowingly helped al-Qaeda in order to convict him of the most serious charge against him, aiding the enemy, a charge he denies. Less publicized, however, is today's development involving media coverage of the trial. Spokespeople for the military announced today new restrictions on media coverage in proceedings that some media have called more restrictive than Guantanamo Bay military tribunals. Today, I spoke with Nathan Fuller of the Bradley Manning Support Network for more information on the new rules. What are the new restrictions on media coverage of the Manning trial that were announced today by the military, and what may have brought them on?
Well, I'll start with that. Last month, Bradley Manning gave a very long and important statement accompanying his guilty plea, which explained at length his reasons for giving documents to WikiLeaks as an act of conscience. And somebody recorded that statement in violation of the court rules and leaked it online. The Freedom of the Press Foundation published that audio. And so since it was a violation, this made the judge and military pretty upset. And so they came back with new restrictions to try to prevent this from happening again. The first thing they did was to ban cell phones from the media center. We're still allowed to have computers, but they banned cell phones and air card. So you're not allowed to have your own Wi-Fi hotspot. You have to use the military's Wi-Fi, which they can shut off at any time and which they do shut off when the court is in session. And also, this new restriction came with what felt to me and to other members of the press like a bit of a threat. It said this media operations center, which means this press room, is a privilege and not a right, and privileges can be taken away. And what that means is that at the judge's whim, this media center could be closed down and that all journalists would have to enter the courtroom to cover the case. And that means no recordings, but also no computers. And so we would have to jot down everything by hand on notebooks. The judge reads sometimes incredibly long rulings for sometimes 2 hours. She's read rulings before, and she reads incredibly quickly. And so it's just not possible to get that all down by hand.
What are the implications of another statement made by the military spokeswoman? Police yourselves. If there is another violation, everyone feels the pain, not just certain individuals.
So that sounds like it's kind of trying to turn journalists against each other. Not surprised that they would want to see infighting within the press room, which has been pretty collaborative.
What access to these proceedings are, or at least are supposed to be, guaranteed by the First Amendment?
Well, that's a little bit up for debate, I guess, because the Center for Constitutional Rights is making a legal petition, has filed a lawsuit essentially against the military to make these documents in this case public, because the ongoing problem throughout this case is that documents have not been made public. We don't have contemporaneous access to the filings. We don't have transcripts, rulings, motions. And the Center for Constitutional Rights has made the case in the Army Appeals Court that it should issue a broad First Amendment ruling that guarantees the press access to these documents. And I fully support that, because I have seen firsthand that it's incredibly difficult to cover this case otherwise.
Do you know what the current status of CCR's lawsuit is?
I was there in October when they made their case. Those judges were critical of both the CCR and the military lawyers, but they were not sure that they had jurisdiction. They said that in some time they would come back, but that's been 6 months now, and they've said nothing to the public, and I've asked the CCR, and they said they're waiting on a ruling just like we are. So in waiting 6 months, I mean, effectively denying the ruling.
What are the Bradley Manning Support Network's goals for transparency in this case overall?
Well, our goal is to get as much access as we can. Ideally, we would love to see this case broadcast on C-SPAN, broadcast on TV, so that the American public can see it. But the military has made it clear that that's not likely to happen. And so the very basic, most reasonable access I can think of is to simply make transcripts and rulings public. they have made a few rulings public online, and they have redacted those, and that's worked out. And there's no reason that we can't have contemporaneous access redacted if it needs to be.
I've been speaking with Nathan Fuller with the Bradley Manning Support Network. This has been Jen Chavez for KBOO News.
This week, a federal judge denied an attempt by the state of California to dismiss or delay a lawsuit regarding solitary confinement in its infamous Pelican Bay prison. The lawsuit, filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights and by others, challenges practices that have seen some Pelican Bay inmates placed in solitary confinement for 1 to 2 decades, sometimes even more. Many of these inmates participated in 2 hunger strikes in 2011 in protest of solitary confinement policies there. The state's Department of Corrections, or the CDRC, had argued that prisoners had not proven cruel and unusual punishment or violations of due process, and that a new pilot program aiming to reform pre-solitary confinement procedures makes the case invalid. But the judge maintained that the lawsuit's claims are valid and has allowed the case to proceed. Lawyers for the prisoners describe solitary conditions in which prisoners are confined for 22 to 24 hours a day in a small, windowless cell with no telephone rights, limited visitation, and restriction from job training or education. They argue that the pilot program, flouted by the defense, has not made lasting changes or impacted their plaintiffs at all. As of 2011, over 500 inmates have been in solitary confinement for over 10 years, and more than 75 inmates have been in solitary for over 20 years. Latino prisoners are disproportionately selected for solitary confinement. While they make up about 40% of the general prison population, they make up 85% of those in solitary confinement. Lawyers for the prisoners plan to file for certification as a class action lawsuit in May, potentially expanding the case's reach to even more prisoners.
Activists rallied in 26 U.S. cities today, calling upon President Obama to fulfill his campaign promise to close the prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. KBOO's Sam Bowman spoke with Layli Kashani of the Center for Constitutional Rights for more on these events.
So you just got back from the protest in Times Square?
Yes, I did just get back from a protest at Times Square on the Broadway and 45th Street, protesting ongoing detention at Guantanamo. And, of course, the immediate occasion was the hunger strike. There's a large-scale hunger strike taking place at Guantanamo that has now entered its third month, so it's quite critical.
I understand you were making specific demands to President Obama to close Guantanamo and end the detainee program there.
I think the basic point that your listeners should know is that it's just simply not true that Obama's hands are tied, that he wants to close the prison and he can't. I mean, 4 years ago, right when he came into the presidency, he immediately promised to close Guantanamo rapidly, swiftly. He then said within a year, and he himself said that Guantanamo should be closed with haste, both because its ongoing existence was a great injustice, and also he cited national security reasons as well. He said it's both makes us less free, in essence, and less safe, and that it really should be shut down. He has failed to do so, and I think people have been blaming Congress. And certainly while Congress hasn't made it easy for the president to act and close the prison, he does have the authority under the law to do so. So a fundamental demand that we were making in New York City today and people across the country were making in multiple sites of demonstrations was that the president must keep his promise to close, must fulfill it, must stop shifting blame for its ongoing existence and use his authority under the law to close it. Actually, today, the Center for Constitutional Rights, drafted and signed a joint letter that we sent to President Obama. It was signed by 25 prominent human rights organizations. It was reiterating a demand for President Obama to close Guantanamo. And we did outline some specific things that he should do to be able to meet that goal. And the first thing, of course, is that he should direct Secretary of Defense Charles Hagel to use his authority to issue the certifications or national security waivers required by the NDAA 2013 to effect transfers from Guantanamo. And what that means is that under the current law, the National Defense Authorization Act, there is a certification process and there are waiver provisions that the Secretary of Defense can use to get men out. So the DOD actually already has this authority, but what we're asking is for the executive, President Obama, to direct the Secretary of Defense to use that authority and actually get men out. And the second demand that the letter makes is that the President Obama, that he should appoint an individual with authority in his own administration to lead the effort to close Guantanamo. Because no office is really charged with that post right now. And there used to be a special envoy, Dan Freed, whose charge was to work on closure, and he was located within the State Department, and that office was closed, and none have taken its place. But the point is, we don't want another Dan Freed. We want an official that has real power, real authority to move forward, to help meet the president's promise to close the prison.
I understand that there are a number of prisoners there who are cleared to be released. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, there's 166 men who remain trapped at the prison, and over half of them, which is 86 men, have been cleared by the Obama administration itself, by every agency with a stake in the matter, intelligence, military, every intelligence and military organization with a stake in the matter has agreed that 86 of the men are cleared, which is more than half the population now, and yet they still remain in prison. Of course, beyond this 86, I mean, the truth is that the vast majority of the 166 men who remain have now been detained without any charge or trial for more than 11 years. And this is really the catastrophe. This is really the root of the unfolding crisis emerging as a hunger strike today. The hunger strike is inexplicable without looking at this 11 years of indefinite detention for the majority of the men, including those who have been cleared by this administration. But really, the injustice of indefinite detention goes beyond them as well.
For KABU Evening News, this is Sam Bowman speaking with Leili Kashani of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
In other Guantanamo news, defense lawyers for the inmates revealed that someone has accessed their emails and servers. Documents have been provided to the prosecution, and others have disappeared completely, some of which have reappeared with obvious changes. It's not clear who took the documents or why, since the attorneys' accounts are still under official investigation, but the affair has left defense attorneys concerned about the integrity of the entire judicial process. This comes after revelations earlier this year that attorney-client meeting rooms at Guantanamo were bugged, and that the live broadcast feed of the trial of several 9/11 conspirators was being cut off by unknown entities outside of the court.
In the latest news from U.S. occupied Afghanistan, four people, including a regional police chief, were killed in southern Afghanistan in two separate explosions. In the Marja district of Helmand province, a civilian died and two more were wounded by a roadside bomb today. And the police chief of the Chora district in Uruzgan province and two bodyguards fell victim to a roadside bombing this morning. The Associated Press attributed rising violence in the region to warming spring weather, as fighting typically subsides during cold winters.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, April 11, 2013. Israeli soldiers injure and kidnap a former political prisoner, and settlers uproot trees owned by local farmers. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers shot and injured, then kidnapped former political prisoner Mu'taz Ubeido, 32, from Hebron City in the southern part of the occupied West Bank. Ubeidi suffered a disability after being shot by the army in November of 2011. His father said that a large military force surrounded his son's store in Wadi al-Haraya area in Hebron and kidnapped him after forcing him to remove his clothes. The Israeli army said that Ubeido resisted the soldiers. That's why one of them shot him in his leg. The Palestinian Political Prisoner Society denied the army claim and demanded Ubeido be released immediately and that international investigation should be conducted in the shooting incident of today. In other news, for the third day, clashes continued on Thursday between Palestinian youth and invading Israeli soldiers in Aida refugee camp in the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem. Clashes were also reported today between invading Israeli soldiers and youth at the village of Al-Khadr near Bethlehem City. At both locations, soldiers used tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets to attack unarmed youth. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. During their attack on Aida refugee camp on Tuesday and Wednesday, Israeli soldiers shot and critically injured a journalist and a civilian. Also in southern West Bank on Thursday, Israeli soldiers started to uproot trees from forest located near the village of Fordais. Villagers say the army is planning to make way for more construction at the nearby illegal Israeli settlement of Tekoa. Moreover, Israeli settlers also on Thursday uprooted around 100 olive trees owned by local farmers from the village of Beit Umar near Hebron City, southern West Bank. Villagers told local news that armed settlers stormed the area and cut off the trees, then threatened landowners, if the farmers come back, they will kill them.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us in the newsroom with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Aaron J. Bernard, Sam Bowman, and Robin Ryan. The producer is myself, Jen Chavez. Our engineer is Matthew Olson, and the KABU Interim Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Rebecca Ney. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K264AA Corvallis, 100.7 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Jen Chavez.
And I'm Robert.